NPR's Main Street Radio coverage of rural issues is supported by the Blandin Foundation, committed to strengthening communities through grant making, leadership training, and convening. Good afternoon, and welcome to our special Main Street broadcast from St. Cloud State University. I'm Rachel Reby. In the past 20 years, almost 53,000 refugees have settled in Minnesota. The majority live in the Twin Cities. But about 15% of the refugees were placed in rural Minnesota and have slowly expanded the ethnic mix. Our guests today are Min Tron, Area Coordinator for Refugee and Immigration Services for Lutheran Social Services in Moorhead, and Diane Kim, a Pelican Rapids School Board member and volunteer who's worked with refugee families in her community. We also have Bob Hultin, who supervises refugee services for the Minnesota Council of Churches and works with communities on racism issues. Our phone lines are open for your questions and comments today at 1-800-537-5252. Again, the number, 1-800-537-5252. We're going to start our conversation talking about Pelican Rapids. Pelican Rapids is a Norwegian community of about 2,000 people in Ottertail County, north of Fergus Falls. Now it's home to a lively mix of Vietnamese, Bosnians, Hispanics, Somalians, among others. Min Tron, how did that happen?
Well, first of all, I'd like to thank Minnesota Public Radio for having me here today, and thank you too. It began when I first started working in December 1979, when our first unaccompanied minors, you know, Asian, Vietnamese, unaccompanied minors, group of young teenagers, you know, begin to arrive. So we needed a foster home for that. We got pretty good response from Pelican Rapids. So we placed a number of kids there. And then next, we began to resettle a few families, a few Laotian families there. A local church sponsored them, and there are jobs right there at the turkey plant. So the family came, and a few months later, they got jobs at the turkey plant. And then over the years, then we got the beginning in 1995, we got our first two families from Bosnia.
And so what are you looking for in a community? Is it critical that there are jobs available, that the refugees could fill those jobs? Is that one of the critical points?
That's one of the critical points, jobs and then support from the community and school and volunteers and all those things together.
So you want those things in place before the people come. It's not something you think, well, they'll grow to love these people. You want to see some interest up front.
Yes. Before we bring a family or a person into the community, we do those things. We do some kind of research first. Number one is job, and then volunteer support is the school system for them. Is an ESL class for them, among other things.
Diane Kim, what happened in Pelican Rapids? You got involved in 1990. How did it happen?
The Ministerium, which is an organization of about 14 or 15 different churches of varying denominations, sponsored a family. Prior to that, the minors, the unaccompanied minors who came and were part of the school system, I was familiar with them because I was on the board at that time. And I just thought it was something that I ought to be involved in. It's a chance for a person in a small town to make a difference in someone's life. My involvement with this particular first family that came was because we had an extra bed. The church bulletin asked for donations of household goods, and so we brought a bed into the family and had a chance to meet the family, and they were charming, and the kids obviously needed some help with their homework after school, so I started stopping over there after work at night, and we'd sit around the table, and I was just awed by their determination to succeed, and a little bit overwhelmed by the obstacles in language, that were there in front of them. But they were willing, I was willing, they had a good ESL teacher in the school, and the school has been very supportive of all of the families and children that have come through its doors.
So is it a question then that once you see, boy, that worked out well, that family's doing well there, let's send another family and another family and another family, is it once the doors open and people are welcome and the jobs are still there that you just keep sending people?
That is correct, but we look at, we also look at the how the local community, how much the local community is capable of helping refugees. So the number of people that come, that we need to take a look at the number too. But at the same time, there are refugees that move to Pelican Rapids from other states. They came because there are jobs there, they came because they have friends there, and they heard about the support there too.
Bob Holteen, how difficult is it for a rural community, a rural white community, a rural white Norwegian community who might think that Germans would be some diversity in town? How difficult is it for them to change that mindset and to welcome other people into their community?
Well, I think it's different for each community, and it's hard to identify what the factors are that really will work. But I think once you determine that you want to become involved in something like refugee resettlement, then you need to start to see what assets you have in your community that can be used towards successfully resettling people who really are coming into a situation having usually just been through trauma, at least in the not too distant past. And so you need to make sure that you have the capacity to do that. Congregations are good support systems for refugee resettlement because they're voluntary associations of people who already have some sense of mission or ministry in the community, hopefully. And so bringing together several congregations can often open up the kinds of dialogues you need in order to meet the needs of the refugees coming in.
Let's go to our phone lines. And again, our number is 1-800-537-5252. If you'd like to join our conversation by giving us a call today, we would invite you to do that. We go now to John, who is standing by in Wilmer. Good afternoon, John. Welcome to this Main Street Show.
Good afternoon. I always enjoy your program. And today, your program is quite fitting and a very timely subject. My question involves, the question is, because I was listening to the program prior to this one regarding the St. Cloud issues, and I think the two really do tie together. It seems to me so often that the successful programs where individuals, families come into a community that need the support of a community come there and are very successfully melded into that community and then from there on develop a diverse part of that community, which is really a wonderful asset to any community because it, the colors on the trees are what makes the trees wonderful. And I think it's the same thing in a community. The question I have, though, is relating to so much of what was spoken about in the previous hour or half hour. Talked about, for example, the St. Cloud community needing to change to meet the needs of these new people coming in. And I think it's so tragic that so many times, new people to a community or guests to a community that are initially coming into a community require the whole community to change rather than the individuals that come into the community trying to find their place in that community and meld into that community. And I'm just wondering if there's a real correlation with the successes in the programs that other communities in Minnesota and other parts of the country have had, where communities are welcomed, welcome individuals and welcome families and other groups in the community where the question is, well, how do we as a community have to change to meet your needs rather than how do these individuals, what do they have to do to meet the standards that are in the community? And
how would you address that? Who needs to change? Is it the people coming in or the people that are there?
Well, I suspect that it's probably a balance, but I guess I would want to say that it is important for a community that wants to call itself welcoming to reevaluate its own way of being. In the church, we talk about providing hospitality to the stranger. And part of that is not just to force or to ask of someone when they come to change and abide by our rules, but it's to reevaluate how we can actually become more hospitable, and that often requires change in us.
Diane, did you see this in working with the families that you did in Pelican Rapids? Was there a sense sometimes on their part that they had to assimilate as quickly as possible and be as American or as Minnesotan as possible? That's the only way they would get along?
I think that was kind of the desire of the family that came first. They wanted their children to learn English and to be part of the community as fast as possible. But I think the community had to make some adaptations, too. A lot of it on the part of the first Vietnamese family that I worked with was wanting to know what the community expected of them. One just kind of a silly example is the father asked me, how much snow do we have to shovel? I said, you shovel enough so that you can get a car in and out and you can get to your house. He thought you had to shovel all the snow off of all of your sidewalks and your yard. And they didn't know what snow meant. And one of the questions that he looked at me and he said, no plant? Wanting to know, you don't grow a garden in the wintertime? So they came with lots and lots of questions, but they were very eager to please and very eager to do what the community expected them to do. So it really wasn't a problem. And then one other thing that I wanted to go back a little bit, when one family comes and then another family comes, that first family is so helpful in helping them to understand what the community expects. The community doesn't have to do it all over again every time. The ethnic community that is there is ready to help them.
They form their own support system.
They do. They still need support from community people, but by and large, they do an awful lot for themselves.
We have a young woman from one of those first Vietnamese families that arrived in Pelican Rapids with us here in St. Cloud today. Chan Kim came from a refugee camp in the Philippines in 1990 when she was 16 years old with her parents, her two sisters, and her brother with no relatives in America, and suddenly you're living in rural Minnesota in Pelican Rapids. How difficult was that, Chan, to begin with? You spoke no English.
No, not at all. At first, we was really scared and lonely, miss home a lot. But later on, we learned to speak English, and we just get along with the community just fine.
What would you say were some of the biggest challenges?
I was scared of the language.
Language was tremendous then, big problem.
It is.
To learn English.
Yep.
How about feeling comfortable in the community? Did you feel like it took years and years before? I mean, this is 9 years ago now. Did it take years for people to accept you and your family, or did you feel like they were welcoming to you?
Because our community is really small, and I mean, at first, feel kind of lonely, but then later on when we start speaking English and people know that we can talk English, so they come and talk to us, and I mean everybody is really nice, and if they know you speak English and they just be friend with you, you know, I guess it's really hard if they don't know you speak English or not, and that's one of the problems that they afraid to come up and talk to you because they don't know what if you know or not. And
so it's not that you saw them be mean, it's just that they were maybe standoffish because they didn't know what
That's
to do.
True.
And have you seen it change tremendously? Your parents have settled there now.
Yeah.
Has it gotten easier now as more refugees have come behind you now? Is there other Vietnamese families in town and other families of other ethnic backgrounds?
I guess we got more background in Vietnamese, but I think it's much easier for us now, and the later family come is easier too because they got us there and we help them out a little bit and the community help out too, so it's easier for the later family.
Well, I understand that your house is quite a center Yep. For people of all nationalities coming.
Yeah.
So there's always somebody coming in, coming out, different people.
That's true.
Right. Mm-hmm. Mintron, the situation in Pelican Rapids, is it typical or is it atypical?
Well, Pelican Rapids is a very special community to me in terms of, you know, we were talking about changes earlier. Refugees who are victims of violence, victims of persecution, victims of war, victims of violence, they are survivors, and they knew when they came here they will face a lot of changes. They came here with a lot of questions. They said, would the new community accept me as a person? What should I do? Would I be able to get a job? Would I be able to learn the language? Would my kids be enrolled in school or be accepted in school? A lot of questions have to be answered.
Did you feel like you can answer those questions for these people? I can understand they would have all these questions, and certainly they would feel comfortable asking them to you, yourself a refugee who came to this country.
Yes.
And this part of the world. And yet, how do you know how people are going to react? People at church could seem quite welcoming into a community, but that doesn't mean the other 1,900 people there would be welcoming as well. Do you just have to kind of step out and hope that things work to begin with?
That is correct. I don't have all the answers for them. Part of our work to help new refugees is to provide the orientation, cultural orientation, employment orientation, orientation about the culture, about the local community, and then we go from there. We go through, we work with volunteers, and volunteers are the friends. My personal experience is that, the friendship, the emotional support that our American friends came to us and said, we are your friend, we are your new friend, you are here with us, we like to be your friend. I think that is very important for a new person coming to this country, also a new refugees, because refugees are survivors.
Rachel, I wanted to say in regards to your question, I think the church, if it's really doing its obligation to hospitality right, it wouldn't just prepare its own members for any people that they're planning to bring in. It would actually be involved in the community, trying to increase the level of discourse there, so that it's not just the members of the congregation that would be changed, but it would be everyone in the community.
And do you think that change happens by, and Diane, maybe you could explain it this, if you feel this happened in Pelican Rapids, often we'll see that change is precipitated by a strong personality who accepts the newcomers, a group of people who, and then other people think, well, they're doing it, I think we'd better jump on the wagon with them. Did that happen in Pelican Rapids where the momentum got going and suddenly the people who were kind of standoffish, they suddenly were in the minority instead of part of the majority? Do you feel that way?
Yes, I believe that's exactly what happened in Pelican. We have a kind of a unique situation because we have a multicultural committee that was formed when community members felt that there was a need for some dialogue and learning about other cultures, and really they did more than have dialogue. They actually got in and got involved by having different multicultural events in town. We have an International Friendship Festival in June that's going into its second year now, that's very successful in bringing all of the different cultures, not only the refugee cultures, but every culture that's available in Pelican Rapids comes together that day to celebrate. And we have ethnic food, ethnic art, and lots of different kinds of things that bring our community together. And the theme is Many Cultures, One Community. And one by one, the new people in the community have kind of been taken under the wing of someone. When the Bosnians came, I just felt that there was so much left for me to do with the Vietnamese that I chose not to get involved with the Bosnians. But someone else took that up and started befriending different Bosnian families that came, found things for them to put in their houses or apartments. and help them get their children enrolled in school, all the things that you have to do as a volunteer when a refugee family comes to town. Then the Somalians came. Someone else took them. And as you get acquainted with families and individuals, that's where you find out that we aren't really all that different.
And is it important for people to remember that they came from someplace else too? It wasn't me, but it was my grandmother, my grandfather,
yes,
that came from Germany. Do we need to remember in Minnesota, which has a rich tradition of all kinds of immigration, does that help, Bob, to remind people, where did your ancestors come from? What did they face when they got to this country? How did it feel for them moving into this predominantly blank community?
I think since most of us who live in Minnesota, our roots are from somewhere else, and usually there's not too many generations back, that you can draw on that to help develop at least a sensitivity. I don't think it's a complete understanding, but it's at least a sensitivity to what people may be going through. The differences, again, are a lot of the people who are coming now, especially the refugees, have gone through trauma. For a lot of the people who came when my family came in the late 1800s, were looking for some economic opportunities, but it wasn't because they were fleeing persecution in Sweden.
Important distinction. We go to the phones. Mathilde from Minneapolis is on the phone with us. Good afternoon and welcome to Main Street.
Good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call. I am a foreigner myself. I'm from Brazil, and I've been in Minnesota for 6.5 years. And to tell you, I love Minnesota. I have been well received here. And the main point, I believe, in this issue is that your standards, you need to see how you behave, what yourself. And if you come, move to another culture and start behaving not the way society standards have over here, then you're going to have a conflict. One gentleman in your panel mentioned the DWB was quite interesting, drive while black. Well, if I were a police chief, I would stop every single car those guys driving because they're scary. They drive with loudspeakers and they drive by shooting. This happens quite often. So I think that the policemen are right in doing that.
And so you think that the people who are moving here need to examine their own actions as well?
Absolutely. That's right. In a situation, in a society that has a large group of people with different backgrounds, you can always have a conflict. However, if you come from outside, you have to adapt yourself to the standards of the society you move into. And I am a minority, as I said, but I've never had a problem. And I do believe the black people, they have this attitude. Not all of them, though. I have black friends, too. Very respectful, very intelligent people, but they need, if they want to conquer what they're looking for, they really need to, raise their standards a little bit and respect others also.
Thank you for your comment today. We go now to Carolyn in Minneapolis. Good afternoon, Carolyn. Welcome to Main
Hello.
Street.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi. I grew up in a rural community, and I think maybe too much emphasis is being made on acceptance because people are different by color. I know that where I grew up, even if you moved into town and you looked like everyone else, you were still considered an outsider until you had lived in the community for a generation.
So acceptance in small towns is a problem for anybody coming in.
I think so, and I think that by emphasizing that, maybe that makes it too much of a negative issue.
Oops,
I can't hear you.
There may be some truth to that. I do think, though, that in a culture that stratifies by race so much, when you move into a community and can never be anonymous, that really changes the way that you're in a community. You may be new, but I think you would still have opportunities sometimes to be anonymous and not feel like you're under public scrutiny all the time.
We're talking today about rural refugees with our guests Diane Kim, Ming Tran, and Bob Hultin. I'm Rachel Reby. Our phone lines are open for your questions and comments at 1-800-537-5252. And we'll be back with more of Main Street and your phone calls after a look at news and weather.
Good afternoon. I'm Tim Pugmire with a news update from Minnesota Public Radio. President Clinton says he's proud of the three U.S. soldiers who were held captive in Yugoslavia. He visited them today in Germany. Clinton also noted the deaths of two Apache helicopter crewmen, saying, "We grieve with their families and pray for them." A humanitarian group says one of its relief convoys has been hit by a bomb in Kosovo. The Greek branch of Doctors of the World says no one in the convoy was hurt. NATO denies its forces hit the convoy. Some Oklahoma City residents are returning to their homes today to see what's left after Monday's tornado. Hundreds of cars lined up at a police checkpoint to get into the devastated neighborhood, which will be sealed off again tonight. It could cost $50 million to get Columbine High School back in shape after last month's shooting rampage. That estimate comes from a top administrator in the school district. Meanwhile, the Denver Post reports witnesses have named someone who might have been a third gunman. In regional news, police plan a news conference this afternoon on the first homicide at the Mall of America. A young woman was apparently stabbed to death at the mall just after the stores closed last night. A 23-year-old man was arrested in South Minneapolis. Police say the suspect and the victim knew each other. The Minnesota House has approved paying three tobacco trial jurors almost $30,000 to cover financial hardships. The money would pay for foreclosure costs, lost overtime, and other fees the jurors suffered during the four-month trial. The Minnesota Zoo says it won't have to lay anybody off. The zoo rescinded 40 layoff notices after the legislature came through with enough money. A zoo spokeswoman says legislative approval came just in time to make the zoo's deadline. And a bill that requires the Board of Medical Practice to register midwives won 51-11 Senate approval. The board has not registered midwives for 61 years. The House needs to approve a final version of the bill as agreed upon in conference committee. Scattered showers and thunderstorms around Minnesota today, especially in the north, highs ranging in the mid-60s. And that's the latest news from Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Tim Pugmire.
You're listening to a special Main Street report from St. Cloud State University. I'm Rachel Reby, and we're talking about the refugees that have settled in towns across Minnesota. My guests are Min Tron, Area Coordinator for Refugee and Immigration Services for Lutheran Social Services, Diane Kim, a Pelican Rapids volunteer who's worked with refugee families, Chan Kim, who came to Pelican Rapids from Vietnam when she was 16 years old, and Bob Holteen, who supervises refugee services for the Minnesota Council of Churches and works with communities on racism issues. Change has not come easily for some rural communities. We have Sue Persig on the phone with us from the west central Minnesota town of Benson in Swift County. She works with the Economic Development Organization in Swift County. Good afternoon, Sue.
Hello.
Hello. When you tried to expand the labor force in Swift County, you met with some resistance. Tell us about that.
Well, we, in one of our businesses, we're experiencing a difficulty in finding enough employees, and the owner of the business suggested, along with one of his contractors, that possibly there was a population in the metro area that may be interested in coming to work for him, and that was members of the Hmong community. We did some community meetings with officials and leaders in the community, and it made it fairly public that this was being considered. And the reaction from the community was about 50-50 as far as being positive and negative toward the concept. It was enough of a concern for the people from the Hmong community that they determined this was not a good place for them to settle. Because they didn't feel welcomed, and they told us that up front, that if they didn't feel welcomed, that they would choose another community and not come here.
So the opposition, how did it present itself? How did people express the fact that they were not open to having members of the Hmong community move to Benson?
I had several phone calls in my office. There were letters to the editor in the paper. There was just a kind of a pulling back of the leadership of the community as far as organizing ourselves so we could have a community meeting to discuss the issue. We had not just myself, but several people in the community were contacted about this.
Bob, does it surprise you that a community might be 50-50 when you're thinking about doing something like this?
No, we do live in a pretty polarized time, and churches are no different in that. But with fragmentation and the kind of fragmentation and isolation we're really experiencing, it's not surprising. I also want to say, though, that it's not that there's nothing that we can do, because I think there are things. Unfortunately, they usually are long-term, and we're probably looking for quick fixes, and most of the quick fixes probably don't help very much.
And Sue, actually, your community then, after the Hmong decided not to come to Benson, the issue didn't stop there. Then you started working on perhaps changing some attitudes, doing some of the more long-term things. Tell us about that.
Right. Because of the reaction in the community and the fact that it happened with several people, not just myself, we got together and decided that maybe this was an issue that the churches in the community should be addressing, because they are supposedly a welcoming to the community type of organization and have a great deal of say about what the social issues are that get discussed or that how people feel about things. So we went to the ministerium and asked for leadership, guidance. What is it that we can do as a community and that they can help us do or they can recommend? And kind of by accident found that two people from Benson had been through a training called Understanding and Dismantling Racism, put on by two people from the Minnesota Council of Churches, Jim and Nadine Addington. And they recommended that we look into that, and they joined our task force as well, which we organized at that point in time to find.
And has that been successful, Sue? You said that they came and they were there actually for several days in the fall. Since then, have you seen attitudes change? Certainly the way that you talk about it is different. I know when I talked about changing people's minds and perhaps making them more tolerant, you said that you were taught in your session, use the word, it's racism. Use the word racism. And do you think things have changed?
Well, I know they've changed for the 34 people that took part in the training. Not that we resolved any problems at that point, but it helped us to understand our own feelings and the fact that racism is a system and institutional. I can't come up with the word here, but it is. We are affected by our systems and institutions that basically keep promoting racism because that's how our history promoted them to be. And by learning that and helping us to understand maybe where some of our attitudes come from, some of our mannerisms and our parts of speech, you know, the way we talk, are all just proliferating, just continuing the process of racism. So at least we know each other is out there. And we have opportunities to plan for how to deal with this issue and how to bring more and more people into the fold of understanding racism.
Is there a sense on the part of the leaders in your community that that group of Hmong will not be moving to Benson, but certainly somebody else other than the current residents of Benson will be moving in at some point?
Well, I think for some people there's a fear of that, and for others it's a reality. We know that will happen. It's happening at this time, probably in smaller groups than the Hmong may have come here. But we are becoming multicultural in a very small way, even at this point. And it's not something we can prevent. We have no gates on this county or community, and we need to understand it and be able to deal with things in a positive way rather than to react to things negatively and make it difficult for others to come here.
So you are not that far from Willmar. Do you think that some of the challenges in that community just got people very frightened?
I do believe that is the case. We've seen some very negative press on the community on Willmar and the situation that has arisen there because of an influx of Hispanics into the community. And I think it has really made people fearful here that we can't have that going on in Benson, so let's put our blinders on and not even think about bringing people here of another culture, and we can avoid those situations.
Sue, thanks for joining us this afternoon on this Main Street special. Thank you. Bobbleteen, you had a comment.
Sue really pointed it to something very important, I think, and that's that the way white people and people of color look at what racism is, even, is quite different. White people tend to think that racism means personal acts of bad behavior addressed towards another person. And I think people of color tend to understand it more as systems being set up that undercut their ability to even be on a level playing field. And so if that's the case, it takes some real intentional effort to dismantle the racism. It takes people saying that this is, in fact, what we want to do. We want to become anti-racist. And what the Minnesota Council of Churches anti-racism initiative does is to train teams within congregations who then work also within the community to try to look at their own congregations or their own institutions dismantle the racism even within their own institutions and congregations.
Min, I wanted to ask you, do you think that when Sue was talking about what's happened in Benson, she was talking about a group of people coming to town, and I don't know how many families that might have been, but do you think it's been easier to move people one family at a time, that if you had said to Pelican Rapids, now we have 30 Vietnamese refugees we'd like to move to town, that people might have said, whoa, wait a minute. Let's take it slower than that. Did it help going slower?
I don't know what happened to other community, but the answer to you is yes and no. It's yes in the way that, yes, if you move one family at a time, the transition is smooth and is easier. But on the other hand, back in August 1996, all of a sudden, we got over 30 Bosnian refugees coming from Memphis, Tennessee, Fargo, Sioux Falls, Texas, all at a time, just at one time, all came there. And I got a call, you know, from a volunteer saying that, Ming, you better come here. There are a number of refugees who need help. They came there because they heard about job, they heard about the community, they came there. So in that way, the community, you know, responds real quick. The response from the community was so quick. The local cultural committee began to organize and gather donation and think that maybe you could talk more about that.
But this was a community too that had already had very positive interactions with refugees moving to town.
That is correct. That is correct.
There were a couple of things that happened before that to more or less get the community ready to appreciate people from another culture coming. The newspaper has been excellent in profiling families who've come to town, and the reporter will come to the house and interview the family. Chun's family had a couple of nice interviews in the paper, telling about their background, telling about why they came to Pelican.
Helping the community get to know them then.
Yes, absolutely. And the Multicultural Committee has had potluck suppers where various ethnic foods of all different kinds have been brought in, and people have a chance to meet people who are new to the community and sample some of the different foods. It probably was our biggest challenge when all of the Bosnians came at once, because we are a small community and we just weren't marshaled enough to meet their needs. But they filled the school cafeteria with donated goods where the new families could go and pick out things that they needed, and we had more than we needed to supply the needs of these new families.
We're going to go back now to our very patient phone caller standing by waiting to participate in this conversation. Good afternoon, Jill. Welcome to Main Street.
Thank you. My name is Jill, and I was born and raised in Pelican Rapids. I now teach refugees at the University of Minnesota in Minneapolis, and I just want to commend the town of Pelican Rapids and all of the people who've really gone out of their way to help make these refugees feel more at home in Pelican. The refugees that I interacted with when I was in high school, most of them were just teenagers who came and lived with different families, and I think they had a harder time getting adjusted to life in Pelican than a lot of the incoming families that are coming now.
Thank you so much for your comment. Thank you, Jill. We go now to Sherburne, where Chandra is standing by. Good afternoon. Welcome to Main Street.
Hello. I went to high school in Pelican Rapids from 1982 to 1986. And during that time, most of the refugees who were there were children from Vietnam and Laos and Cambodia. Excuse me. And they had been brought in and were fostered. A large group was fostered by the Catholic priest, and another large group was fostered by a high school teacher. And I think that kind of acceptance from community leaders and the fact that it was children who were then interacting with other children in the town helped to open up the door within that community for making it easier for those who followed to come in.
And how was it for you as a young person yourself in those days? Was it surprising to you? Was it exciting to have somebody else in town?
Well, I had moved through several different rural towns throughout the Midwest and arrived there when I was 12. And it was nice for me. I have older sisters who are Hispanic, and to be in a town where there wasn't that kind of prejudice that my older sisters had seen, or there was less of it because there were more people who were not white, who had black hair. It was nice to see the difference.
Hmm. Thank you for your comment this afternoon, Chandra. Mm-hmm. We're going now near Owatonna, where Pauline is waiting to join us. Good afternoon, Pauline. Welcome to Main Street.
Thank you. First, I want to really thank NPR for doing both the urban-rural dialogues between Crookston and North Minneapolis, and also this one, because as you might guess, in outstate Minnesota, it gets pretty isolated when you're dealing with issues like this. So this has been a wonderful forum. In Owatonna, about 3 years ago, a large number of Somali refugees came because there's a good job base here. And in addition to the racism that has been here and is throughout Minnesota because it's been so homogeneous, the challenge here, I think, also includes the Muslim faith and Christian dialogues. So I'm wondering, in Pelican Rapids, and by the way, some of us have been reading about Pelican Rapids and want to come to your International Friendship Festival, and I think the date is June 26th this year.
That's correct.
But our cultural diversity network that was formed 3 years ago when the Somalis started coming is trying lots of different things, but we really need the kind of networking and ideas from other communities to share. But if the panel could deal with the Muslim-Christian dialogue, that would be very helpful.
And your specific question, Pauline?
Well, are there ways that Christian churches are finding to be welcoming and inclusive with the Muslim families, and how they're finding ways to break down those barriers of both, because the schools, all the communities who are dealing with the Muslims now are having to scramble in terms of dietary things, prayer practices, and it's a big leap for Northern European Christians.
Yes, let's have Bob Holteen from the Minnesota Council of Churches address that. What do you think, Bob? What are some of your ideas?
The council's been a little behind on this, I would say. We have been involved in refugee resettlement for a while and have also had Muslim-Christian dialogues going on for 20 years, and yet we haven't used the resources that have been involved in the Muslim-Christian dialogues to help with the spiritual needs of incoming refugees. The kinds of needs could include finding space for public worship and I know that in some communities there has been discussion of using churches or using spaces that churches do have that they're willing to allow to be used by the small Muslim community that might exist there. But it is on our radar screen to try to be talking with people. So I'd encourage people who are in communities that are experiencing this and would like to see some sort of dialogue like this take place in their communities to give a call to the Minnesota Council of Churches.
Do you think this is one of the real difficult issues, that it would be easier to move into a small town? I know one of the families you talked about, they were Baptists, the Vietnamese, that moved to Pelican Rapids. Is that somehow easier for the community to embrace a family or members from different ethnicity, but they share a common religious background? Are they more open? You talk about working with churches to sponsor people. Do they want to know what the faith system is, what their beliefs are, before they say, come on, we'd like to help you? Are they open to helping people of all faiths?
Yes. We ask church congregation to help a refugee family. That's not the question. But we always provide the congregation with the background information of the family that's coming, including the their faith. Okay. And in Pelican Rapids, we have a number of refugees who are Muslim. And we provide the information about where there is a mosque that's for them, so they can come and worship. And 45 miles away from Pelican Rapids, there's a mosque in Fargo. Many of them worship at home. They do it at home. They gather together. They pray. Local employers also are very familiar. They are aware of their faith, and part of the orientation is to the work is that you know, if they wish to worship, they work to pray at a certain time. That's, you know, that's something that could be discussed too.
Try to work those things out ahead of time.
Yes.
Let's go back to the calls. Tim from Moorhead is on the phone. Good afternoon, Tim. Welcome to Main Street.
Thank you. In Moorhead, through the First Congregational Church, we have sponsored 3 Vietnamese families, and we worked with Minh Tran very closely, so I know Minh well. And my comment is that I encourage churches and I encourage individuals to find out about how they can become involved, because for my family, and I think our church, it was and has been and still is one of the most rewarding, enriching, positive things we've been involved in. The first family came 9 years ago. Parents of that family now live in Pelican Rapids, and the 3 sons live in Moorhead. We are good friends with that family. We still do things with them. We tutored them, and then they came over and tutored our kids in math. We socialize, help each other out, and it's really been the most positive thing I think I've been involved in the last 10 years. And I thank Minh for that opportunity and encourage people to get involved. You'll get more out of it than you put in.
Thank you, sir. We go to Yur now, who is standing on the line from St. Paul. Good afternoon, sir. Welcome to Main Street.
Thank you for taking my call. I'm Maul, and I live in St. Paul. And I just want to have a comment to share that as an immigrant experience in this country, it's hard sometimes, but when you get in here longer and you just kind of get along with the people. But I would like to say that myself as an immigrant, and when somebody tell me, such as you not belong here or you go back to your country, I just want to say that that's really hurt. And I'm not mad at the person, but it just made me really hurt that, you know, you don't know what to do. And I would like to share that I do have lots of American friends that are very nice, and I thought maybe those people that are saying that maybe they don't understand, and there are still time that we could be neighbor and explain. But I think communication is the best part, that, you know, talk to the people and be friend with them. And maybe it's not so bad, that maybe it's not the way every other people think how bad it is, but if you have communication with them, and it just, that's the best way to solve the the discrimination and the way that, you know, different colored people being together. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Do you think, Ming, that it's a lot of the attitude of the people moving in as well? Is that as important as the attitude of the community? Does it work both ways? Do both need to be open?
Yes, I think I think there's racism even in us too. You know, sometimes we say things, we think things, we do things that we, you know, unwittingly, they show that we are kind of biased. So I think that, but the caller says something that I kind of agree. It people need to know that it's hurt.
Mm-hmm.
It hurt to to hear those things, you know. So it's really hurt.
We go back to the phone. One more phone call. Hank from New York Mills, who is standing by. Good afternoon.
Hi. Say, I was just going to talk about the point about you talked about the different groups we had that settled in Minnesota, like the Irish and the German and Norwegian, and the conflicts that they had years ago, and how there we have the new conflicts now. I think the difference is across the last 20 years, that we've all been lumped together into one group by ourselves and by every other ethnic group. We are now all considered white. We all, it doesn't matter which background we have, and I think that has done some good and bad things. Hello?
Yes. And so you're...
You know, as far as like a bad thing, I think we've lost some of our cultural identity, but in a good way, if we can get past our ethnic differences and backgrounds, maybe we can get past the color thing too. And maybe eventually that won't matter either.
Comments about that? Diane, what do you think about that? And when we talk about ethnicity and we talk about the Norwegian community of Pelican Rapids.
Well, the Norwegians felt comfortable staying with other Norwegians. And I think when the Vietnamese came, they felt very comfortable because there were other Vietnamese there. But going back to the idea of the melting pot, the new thought is that it's now a salad bowl. And the appreciation of the... They don't have to meld in. They can be part of without being completely identified with. We can appreciate each other's individual. And I want to echo back to what Tim was saying for myself personally. This was probably the most rewarding thing I've ever done, was to be able to be involved with the refugee community. And I would recommend it to anyone.
And is Pelican Rapids a better community today because of this?
Absolutely. Anytime we have something coming our way, whether it's, it involves some kind of a change, we have a number of ways that we can look at it. We can either look at it as an opportunity, or we can wring our hands and wish we could go back to things the way they used to be. We can't do that.
Diane Kim, Bob Hultin, Chan Kim, and Ming Tran, thank you for being with us today. This special Main Street Radio broadcast is a production of Minnesota Public Radio. Our engineers are Rick Kaczynski in St. Cloud and Randy Johnson in St. Paul. Our producer is Sarah Meyer. Executive producer, Mel Summer. Site producer, Carrie Dwyer. We'd also like to thank Marcia Shoemaker and Ed Buffard for making this broadcast from St. Cloud State University possible. We invite you to visit the Main Street website. Go to www.mpr.org. You'll be able to hear this broadcast as well as other Main Street reports. The address again, www.mpr.org. NPR's Main Street radio coverage of rural issues is supported by the Blandin Foundation, committed to strengthening communities through grant making, leadership training, and convening. Minnesota Public Radio's Main Street team consists of 12 reporters at NPR bureaus across Minnesota. I'm Rachel Reeby.